high inputs of fertilizers and the high disturbance caused by regular ploughing is really bad for the abundance and diversity of these fungi in the soil. And so let's say we can put these beneficial genes into our crops. We then plant them into soils. Maybe there aren't that many fungi there, or as many as there could be. And so I think getting the most out of these symbiotic interactions, these mycorrhizas in agriculture, is going to need changes in not just the crop genetics, but also the way the land is managed. And fortunately, there is actually a movement at the moment, small but growing, that recognizes that the way we're treating the soil needs to be changed so that it improves the sustainability of agriculture. And it's given the title regenerative agriculture. And it's got these five key principles of maximizing plant diversity on the land, integrating livestock so that you've got a natural fertilizer being added in the manure, protecting the soil surface so that you don't get this bad erosion. And two points that are really key to mycorrhizas are minimizing the soil disturbance, so you're not breaking up all of those fungal mycelia in the soil, and maintaining living roots. As I said, the plants are the only source of carbon for these fungi. And so if plants are harvested in the autumn and then there's nothing growing in that soil until the next spring, that represents months and months where the fungus has to survive on its own stored carbon and it can't get any from the plant. If the farmers are maintaining living roots year round in that soil, then that's providing that carbon for the fungi and providing a sort of stronger and more diverse fungal network in the soil. And a couple of ways they can manage the land, the farmers. Increasingly popular is to plant what's called an understory. So you'll grow something like clover in the soil year round, and then you'll plant wheat or barley or maize directly into that. And those crops will grow up through the clover, and you've got that constant ground cover protecting the soil surface, as well as providing carbon for the mycorrhizas. And the best thing about clover is the additional benefit is that it also interacts with some soil bacteria, which can fix nitrogen from the air. So they're providing this nitrogen source that's an alternative to synthetic fertilizers. And so when farmers grow clover, that means they need to use less fertilizer than they need to buy. And another way of looking after the soil surface is, instead of conventional ploughing, which turns over the entire soil surface, they can use techniques such as strip tillage. So this plough is only turning over half of the soil across the field in these rows that you can see here. And so those bands of soil which are left unturned are helping to maintain that living root in the soil, as well as protecting the soil surface. And then the crop can be sown in those gaps which have been turned over. And the whole idea here is that, or the goal, or the situation we hope to head to, is that the nitrogen fixing from plants like clover and the increased phosphorus uptake from plant, from the mycorrhizal fungi can help us reduce that fertilizer input onto this land. And I really want to test this. So the regenerative agriculture sort of community is crystallized around a groundswell movement, it seems, in the UK. And I was at the Groundswell conference in June, and it was great to hear so many farmers talking about looking after the soils. And so many of them knew what mycorrhizal fungi were and how important soil microbes are, and how the science is showing that. And so I'd really like to test how conventional and regenerative agriculture practices compare their impact on the mycorrhizas, and really want to see whether mycorrhizas are more beneficial in regenerative agriculture systems than in conventional. I suspect they will. And so I'm putting together a network of farms across the country. We've got two or three signed up already who are very happy for us to have trials on their fields. And what I'm hoping to do is to find farms where they have regenerative agriculture fields in one site, and then just over the fence there'll be a field under conventional management. And so we end up with this perfect paired design. So we've got soil type and land history and climate that's all exactly the same, and the only difference between those fields is that one's under conventional management and one's under regenerative agriculture. And so we can then test the effect of these mycorrhizas in those two different cropping systems. So that's the aim. That's another a part of the work that I'm doing here at the Crop Science Centre. And I'll be updating you soon with how that's going. So that's all I had for today. And thank you for listening. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much, Tom. And I realized that the recording started halfway your presentation. So sorry. So I need your slides at some point. I don't know why I didn't start. Yeah. But a quick question, and then it would be great to hear from everyone who knows a lot more than me, I'm sure. Just a quick question. I mean, who the farmers that you were talking to, are they small holder farmers? What was the sort of size? Because the question comes from effectively, why would a farmer resist then the regenerative approach and persevere with the conservative one?
Yep.
Is it a matter of cost? Is it a matter of, what are the sort of the the limitations? And
there are a few limitations. So the benefits of regenerative agriculture often take a few years to be seen, and so during that time you're not getting the yield increases or the reduction in labor costs going full regenerative, and so you're stuck where it's a cash flow problem, I think, largely. As well as that, it's quite untested, so there may be sort of cultural inertia to shift to a completely different way of farming. As well as that, there's machinery availability. Yeah. Those different techniques require different equipment, which is not immediately available to everybody.
So what would be the way of overcoming this challenges? Maybe then support from the government? Could there be some kind of subsidies?
It's a good question. Potentially, yeah. I think a lot of farmers also need it to be proved to them that the different farming practices can work and do work, and that they're willing to change. I think the manufacturers are definitely going to manufacture different machines and make them available to farmers, but it's going to be the bigger farms that have got the cash to switch first that can do that, and others will make the change as and when they can if they decide to.
Are you looking at other countries to sort of compare the practices and maybe use that as a supporting your
We're not at the moment at the Crop Science Centre. We're sticking with the UK. One issue is funding, so finding support for that across Europe. But there are a number of studies which have done surveys across Europe looking at different agricultural systems and different techniques, so comparing conventional and organic, and farmers who use no tillage, no ploughing or anything. And these less impactful, so less inputs and less disturbance, have been shown consistently to be beneficial for the mycorrhizas. So I don't think it's just a UK thing, but I'd love to test it wider. But yeah.
Well, thank you, Tom. I have more questions, but I'll stop here for a moment. Please, anyone would like to ask a question or make a comment? Martin, please.
Thanks for a great talk, Tom. It's just a basic question, probably a very simple answer, is I haven't quite understood why selection for the beneficial crop genotype isn't very strong even without human intervention. Is there the ones that the crop genotypes that have more towards the left-hand parasitic end, do they have some separate ecological advantage? Otherwise, why aren't they selected out?
It's a very good question. I'm not entirely sure. So in wild plants, there's a very strong evolutionary selection for it. So about 70% of higher plants are mycorrhizal, and pretty much all the grasses. And so in natural systems, yes, they are pretty much all mycorrhizal. In cropping systems, I'm not entirely sure. There's a theory that the plants have been bred for this high input system and to respond very well to being bathed pretty much in nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium fertilizers. And so if that nutrition is there, available, just on tap, as it were, they've got no incentive to spend their carbon engaging with beneficial microbes because they don't need to. And any carbon that is put below ground to mycorrhizas, in the eyes of plant breeders, may be seen as wasted compared to carbon that could go into grain, which is then yield.
It might be quite interesting to look at some old land races that kind of, if you like, a pre-modern, to see whether they, what their genotype's like.
They do. So that has been done. And what you'll find is that the older genotypes respond a lot more positively to inoculation, but they're starting from a much lower base. So their yield without the mycorrhizas is very low. Right. And then with the mycorrhizas, it's higher. But if you compare that to a modern variety, that's even higher still. Mm-hmm. And so that genetic improvement has just sort of pushed that reliance on mycorrhizas out. But we're hoping to find that there isn't that sort of that absolute choice between engaging with mycorrhizas and having a good yield. So it's looking promising, but we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Work in progress, for sure. Yeah. Ryan, please.
Thanks, Tom. I hope I can sneak in two questions. One of them is pretty short, I think. And I'd love to talk with you more at some point, because I'm working on a project looking at mycorrhizal fungi and forage grasses in Brazil, which is not only a completely different location, of course, but more in forage grasses than like cultivation. But anyway, I'll reach out. My question, the first one is about no-till practices and the use of herbicides. So you mentioned a lot about fertilizers. I was curious if you know of any effect that herbicides have on the mycorrhizal relationships. And in particular, again, I'm coming from Brazil, where no-till agriculture relies heavily on herbicides. Yeah. So there's sort of this, like, you know, playoff between not tilling up the soil but having to use a lot of herbicides. So that's one question. And the other one is, you mentioned the sort of 5-week time frame that you were using to select for the 99 different varieties. I'm curious if you have any thoughts as to, like, you know, if you extend that up until, like, typical harvest time of wheat, if you would anticipate any other different results, potentially, you know, more exciting results, because that seems like somewhat short. Anyway, thanks again.
Yeah. Okay. So with the herbicides, yes, I think there has been an effect shown, and quite a few studies have shown that pretty much any synthetic inputs you put in are not good for mycorrhizas or soil microbes generally. It's really difficult to find good scientific data because field trials are very expensive. And so very often what you're doing is surveys of different agricultural practices. And so I think the biggest study of its kind is one of that survey I mentioned before across Europe. And that was looking at organic versus conventional agriculture, where you've got no herbicide inputs, but you've also got different pesticides and fungicides that are also not allowed. So saying that it's just herbicides is difficult. You can't do that exactly. But if you're using herbicides, you're killing off the plants. And so you're restricting the carbon input to the mycorrhizas. And they can't scavenge carbon from the soil. They have to get it from a living root. So in that sense, yes, they're not great for the herbicides, not great for the mycorrhizas. About the timescale of the greenhouse experiment, we were limited by budget there on how long we could keep the plants in the greenhouse. So I would have loved to have kept them for longer. They weren't even at flowering, obviously, at that stage. But I know that they can affect flowering time. So mycorrhizas can induce earlier flowering in crops, in grasses. But as to how far we can extrapolate the data we have, I was reassured by some collaborators at ADAS that the shoot growth at 5 weeks is a fairly good predictor of how that plant is going to go on to perform. You know, we did what we could with the resources, but yeah, longer trials definitely. So we've got some field trials actually up and running and planned for the Crop Science Centre. So again, I'll be able to update you later.
Thank you, Ryan. You should definitely go and visit the Crop Science Centre. It's really interesting what they have up there. Andy, please.
Thanks very much.
Nice to see you again, Andy. Actually, you came to the TAA seminar.
Yeah, nice to see you again. I saw the TAA email about your meeting, so really grateful.
Thank you.
No, just thanks ever so much, Tom. Really interesting presentation. I'm just interested, I guess, a bit about the increase in sale of inoculants to farmers, including mycorrhizal fungi, and I'm kind of interested to hear your opinion of that. I mean, have sort of companies promoting those inoculants have they sort of tried to get out there a bit too early before the research has been done? And is your research showing that actually the natural mycorrhizal fungi is sufficient, or are there significant benefits to the addition of these inoculants?
Yep. It's funny you say that. We got some data from our first field trial a couple of weeks ago, and we inoculated four different types of barley with mycorrhizal inoculum, which was a commercial inoculum, and we found no effect at all. So there's a natural no effect on yield, but also no effect on the amount of colonization in the roots. So there is still, in conventional agricultural soils, there is still plenty of mycorrhizal fungi there colonizing the roots. Whether they're very beneficial or not, we don't know yet. We need to do further trials. On the inoculants, I would say that I'm still skeptical whether they might have been rushed to market before there's really good, strong evidence to show that they are highly beneficial. I think there's a few studies to show. I know there's one in potatoes to show that inoculation can be very beneficial. And I think inoculum manufacturers might have clung to that and using that as a lot of their, doing a lot of heavy lifting for their marketing, shall we say.
Yeah, there seems to be quite a lot of excitement, but you never quite know when it's another case of the emperor's new clothes with certain bits of agricultural research. Sorry to say such a thing.
Well, we were using almost sterile systems in the greenhouse there, and we were getting 80% growth increases in some lines of that wheat. And so the mycorrhizas have definitely got a lot of benefit to give some crops. It's just working out the conditions in which we can get those benefits. And of course, not all species of mycorrhizal fungi are as beneficial as each other. So there's that whole other complexity of which fungi are we selecting, you know, in the way we do our soil management as well, that also needs addressing.
Thank you, Andy. I think we need a bit of skepticism as well, right? Challenge, work. Brian, please, you have a question or comment.
Yes. Thank you, Tom. Very interesting talk. I used to be a wheat geneticist. I've now moved on to oil palm, but you tested 99 wheat lines, and I'm just wondering what the genetic variation is in the lines that you tested. And I'm particularly interested in the developmental genes of wheat, so the semi-dwarf genes, the RHT genes, the vernalization genes that determine spring or winter habit, and of course the photoperiodic genes as well. Does your data segregate among these gene classes of wheat?
So that's a great question, and we were torn because the more diverse panel, sort of genetically diverse panel you use for these, we suspect the more diverse response you're going to get from inoculation. Those 99 lines we actually used were a mapping population. So they're derived just from two parents, just across. It was the Avalon and Cadenza actually that I mentioned before. It's a mapping population derived from those. And they're all spring wheat lines that we used.
And they're all semi-dwarf as well, are they?
Yes, they are. Sorry, yeah. So,
yes.
Okay. As similar as we find, really, but we still get that huge diversity in responsiveness.
Well, I'd be interested in the effect. When I was working on barley, looking at nutrient uptake, the semi-dwarf genes in barley, there's two types. There's the Golden Promise dwarfing gene, and also the other sort of the dwarfing gene that reduces the plant height but not root length, but the Golden Promise dwarfing gene does, and it has a big effect on nutrient uptake. So I'm also wondering whether root characteristics are also involved in these mycorrhizal associations.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. There's that trade-off between carbon investment in roots and carbon investment in mycorrhizas, because obviously the plant's only got a finite amount of resources to divide up.
Right. Okay, that's my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Tom, I just wanted to ask you, are you working also with pulses?
No, not at the moment.
Do you think that's an area that can be looked at, given the natural nitrogen fixation that they have anyway?
Yeah, definitely. So another part of the work that my group leader, Charles Oldroyd, is working on is trying to get the nitrogen fixing symbiosis into cereal crops. So move them from the legumes into grasses, essentially, so that we can have crops that are engaging with the beneficial soil fungi and soil bacteria, so that they're getting symbiotic nitrogen as well as phosphorus. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think as well as that, the legumes will already be engaging with these mycorrhizal fungi, so I'm sure there's capacity there to breed those to improve that interaction. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because we're working also what we're supporting. A lot of work on the forgotten or orphan crops, and mm-hmm. So I wonder if, for example, focusing on the reintroduction of some of the forgotten crops that can of course grow in the UK, given that you're basing your work on the UK, but is that also a possibility of or going towards the more regenerative farming?
Yeah, absolutely. So our funding is from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for subsistence farmers in sub-Saharan Africa. Mm-hmm. So we're working in barley because that's how we can do the genetic techniques, but ultimately we're moving forward to working in maize and the sort of genetic material they have out there. So as well as maize, looking at cassava and cowpea and things like this. For
millet? Have you been looking at millet?
We're not at the moment, but again, it's another, as well as TEF.
Another stream. TEF. Yeah. George, please. Question, comment.
Sorry, I missed your talk, but I can imagine what was sort of in it. We're in roughly in the same group, for those who don't know. I was going to ask, have you done in your previous job, or have you got any ambition to look at the optimum nitrogen fertilization for these crops? I imagine that completely stopping fertilization full stop will have pretty significant yield penalties, but I imagine there'll be sort of a sweet spot where the plant is receiving nutrients from fertilization and via the symbiotic route. Is there any plan to do that, or have you done it in the past?
I haven't, but it's definitely something I've got plans for. As you say, there'd be that sweet spot between starvation almost, and if you apply excess fertilizer, it's already bad for sort of runoff and stuff being volatilized to the environment. Obviously, that's the ultimate goal, to get as much nutrition through the symbiotic route as possible while not damaging yields too much, and topping up with synthetic fertilizers where needed. But yeah.
George, are you happy about the answer? Yeah,
I could ask questions all day.
That's okay. We have a little bit more time. If anyone would like to ask more questions, and Georgie, if you want to follow up, feel free. Anyone else has more questions or comments or sort of thoughts? Ryan, yes, please.
Is it fine if I ask another question?
Of course, yes.
I was thinking about some of the other questions that were asked by, I think it was Brian that maybe asked about the winter wheat or versus spring wheat, and even extending the project beyond looking at other crops in Africa and then ostensibly other soils, right?
Yeah.
To what extent do you see the sort of like seasonal changes, right? So I think one of the things, I'm from North Dakota in the US and I grew up on a farm. And of course, like one of the sort of advantages there with winter wheat is planting in the fall. So are there like these important seasonal factors that you're going to try and consider going forward, and how will that change the research?
I am not entirely sure. So all the time the plants aren't photosynthesizing, the mycorrhizas obviously aren't getting much carbon from them. And the biomass of the mycorrhizas in the soil reflects that. So through the winter, they shrink right back and produce spores, which are then germinating and infecting or colonizing more roots in the spring when they grow back. But I'm not sure how to address that, to be honest. If you've got any ideas, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, well, like I said, I'll reach out because we're working in the tropics. So maybe there's something there. And I'm a social scientist, actually. So well, for whatever that's worth, you know, you might look down
on me. That's really worth, Ryan. We need social scientists together with plant scientists. Stephen, maybe have you got an answer to this, perhaps, or further comments, or have a question?
No, I have a question, please. So first, thank you, Tom, for your presentation. Very interesting. And my question is in relation to your field trial. So are you expecting that the mycorrhiza, that is not only in relation to the genotype that's important, but in relation to the environment as well, in the site, that in some sites your mixture of mycorrhiza will perform quite well, but in other environments less so? And does that mean that we need to think more about selecting mycorrhiza for specific environments, or do you think it's more universal than that and that's not really a concern and we should just concentrate on the genotypes?
That's a good question. My hope is that we can find some mechanism, some genes in the plant which confer a sort of universal mycorrhizal benefit, so that if we put those into any crop, they will improve, at least to some extent, that crop's response to mycorrhizas. But as you've suggested, I know that the identity, the sort of makeup of the fungal community depends on soil type, pH, the parent material of the rock underneath. And so I think we are going to have to think really carefully about how we can get the most out of this symbiosis in different systems. And there's another concern I know people have with spreading the inoculum on, is that that's nearly always a standard off-the-shelf mix of inoculants, which are the same wherever you want to use them. And you're then introducing fungi, which may be completely alien to that soil, which they may not proliferate in that soil at all, in which case you've wasted your money, or they may then become invasive in that soil. And I don't think there's any testing going on that's sufficient to show if that's a problem. But certainly plenty of challenges, yeah.
And I guess, Tom, also the air itself, I suppose, has an impact. I mean, it's not just the subsoil, it's above as well.
Yeah. So,
sorry, go ahead.
If I can just ask one more, will you be measuring? And how do you measure to see whether one of your, whatever is in that mixture of mycorrhiza, whether one dominates and whether that's going to be different in different environments or in relation to the genotype? So whether that's part of your strategy and how you would actually do it.
Yep. So we've got some mutant barley types that don't form mycorrhizas. And so we're going to grow them with the standard barley types, and then we'll compare those and see what effect the mycorrhizas are having. And then we'll take root samples and we extract the fungal DNA from the roots, and we can then sequence that DNA and we can work out which mycorrhizal fungi have colonized that plant in that location. And so we can compare, looking at two different sites, if one's getting a benefit from the mycorrhizas and one isn't, it might be because the fungi in those sites are different. Or it might be that the fungi are the same, but soil pH is different. So we know then that there's that interaction between the fungi and the crop and the soil. And so, yeah, lots of different interactive factors.
Okay, very impressive. Thank you.
George,
please. Tom, so you said in the start of the questions that farmers probably don't care so much about the fungus sequestering carbon. I think probably with the new ELMS policy, they probably will start to, if not, they're thinking about it already. In your experiment with the multiple cultivars, you looked at plant response, but did you look at how those plant microbe interactions were sequestering carbon and producing hyphal networks?
No, we didn't. We didn't have time to get that data. But it's experiments I've done in the past have shown that different plants support bigger or smaller amounts of fungal biomass in the soil, and then that can affect how effective that fungi is at getting those nutrients out of the soil. So again, that's another factor to think about. It becomes a lot more difficult to do out in the field because extracting the fungi from those soils is a lot messier, and it's just not as effective, but definitely something I want to look at, yeah.
Thank you, George. If anyone else has any comments or questions, any more thoughts? Tom, I wanted to ask you a quick question, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Stephen, it's not scientifically really related, so I'll let you ask a question first. Stevens.
Sorry, thank you. Thank you for allowing me to ask another question. Do you have any interests in trichodermas and looking at those, not so much in terms of nutrition, but in terms of disease resistance? Or sorry, not really disease resistance, but as a strategy antagonistic to resistant to pathogenic fungi.
It's not my speciality, but I do want to look at the effect of disease or the effect of these microbes, mycorrhizas on disease. As I said, there is good evidence that they can reduce the effect of other fungal pathogens on the plants. This is a bit tricky because almost all plants out in the soil are mycorrhizal anyway, and so these tests have to be done in the greenhouse. And that brings a whole host of other sort of questions of how reliable and realistic is it. But it is something I'm hoping to address with these new lines that can't form mycorrhizas. We can test that and see how they compare in their disease incidence and how susceptible they are, yeah.
So the idea is to have it outside of the greenhouses, right?
Yes, that's it, yeah. So
in a real environment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we're in partnership with NIAB and they're running field trials for us, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Stuart.
Thank you.
So then my question in a way follows Stephen's comment, which I was about to make. I mean, given that obviously I run an interdisciplinary research center, I mean, how much do you feel that your work is considers other disciplines, and you feel that you would benefit from being exposed to other, you know, to other disciplines, other areas, including social sciences, mm-hmm. you know, and do you feel that there is not enough exposure? How would you go about, and how can we even support doing that?
Yeah,
I hope it would benefit.
I think definitely because these changes are only going to happen if the farming communities and these people take up or are willing to experiment or help. And we need to learn from them because nobody knows more about their farms than the farmers themselves and the crops they're growing. So absolutely, it's a sort of interdisciplinary challenge, definitely.
Mm. Do you feel that sometimes work really leads you to being isolated and not really talking to other disciplines and therefore absorbing other points of view?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, how can we, essentially, my question is, how can I also, from an IRC, from a GFS IRC, help your work to be more interdisciplinary?
Well, I'll have to think about it. I'm not sure.
Okay, have a think.
I'll get back to you.
Okay. Great. Anyone else's final comments or questions before we let Tom off the hook? Brian, final comment or question?
Tom, my ears pricked up when you started talking about testing mutants. I'm a big fan of mutants. Are these barley mutants that you're thinking about, or can you tell us more about it? What you're planning?
Yeah, they are. So they're barley mutants that have been gene edited so that they can't form mycorrhizas. The signaling that allows the fungus and the plant to interact at an early stage has been knocked out. And so it simply doesn't form the symbiosis. And they've not been tested out in the field. They've not really been tested much at all in terms of how that impacts their growth with and without the fungi. So that's next week or two, they're going into the greenhouse to start those trials.
Super, that's exciting stuff. I know there's lots of root mutants in barley. So there's roots that are curly, ones which are short, ones which are hairless, and ones which don't respond to gravity. Have you looked at any of these at all?
I've not personally, but I know other groups have. The root hairless one especially has had quite a bit of work, because the root hairs on barley obviously are there to increase the surface area of the roots and improve nutrient uptake. And the mycorrhizas are especially beneficial to the root hairless mutants of barley, obviously, because they increase that surface area that the root hairless ones have lost. Again, I don't think we have those mutants, so if we can get hold of them, I'd definitely be keen to test some of those different rooting characteristics and see how they interact with the fungi. Yeah.
I'm afraid you've all frozen on me, but thank you if you can hear me.
We can still hear you, Brian, actually. Yes, you froze as well for a bit. Thank you. Before we finish, I would encourage, if you like, given that you seem to have obviously things in common, and if you would like to carry on talking, if you want to use the chat and just drop your email address, and then I hope that you can get in touch and continue conversations. You know, these seminars are also really to generate hopefully collaborations and dialogue. So please feel free to do so. Tom, if you would like to leave your email address there, that would be great. Please. That'd be wonderful. Great. Well, thank you so much. If there are no more questions or comments, that's wonderful. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you all.
And I would like to take the opportunity actually now to just advertise an event that we are running next Wednesday. It's the first event for the Forgotten Crop Society, actually, Wednesday at 5:30. And it's going to be a series of dialogues. And the first one is on next Wednesday. So I'll send the details. So we have quite a renowned chef and the head of research at the University of UM6B in Morocco. I'll look out for this event. So we'll look at specifically Fonio, one of the forgotten crops, and how this Senegalese chef has been making into an ingredient that can revitalize the economy. So that's great. Thank you so much for everyone. Any more burning questions or comments before we close? No. That's great. Anyway, thank you so much. Thank you, Tom. That was great.
Thank you
very much.
And have a good weekend.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
virus.